He got me good. Sacha Baron Cohen got me good. And by the way, when Sacha Baron Cohen gets you good, all you can do is say, fuck it, he got me.
Yeah. Welcome to the Career Circus, the story night podcast that uncovers crazy career stories. The stories that you tell your friends over drinks that are just too wild, too funny, or too awkward to keep to yourself. We're bringing them to life. Each week, we're joined by incredible guests from the worlds of politics, business, government, sports, and media who are brave enough to share the most unbelievable career stories. From surprising screw-ups to hilarious misunderstandings, we're exploring the lighter, stranger side of professional life. So get ready to be shocked and tickled because this is where career paths get truly entertaining. And today, I'm thrilled to welcome former U.S. Congressman Joe Walsh. Between training to become an actor, studying public policy at the University of Chicago, where I also studied, and becoming a social worker, Joe's journey to Congress was anything but typical. He was elected to Congress in 2010, and since leaving Congress, he's become a prominent, outspoken voice on American politics. Joe even challenged Donald Trump for the Republican nomination for president in 2020. His passion for defending American democracy can be found on his Substack, which is called The Social Contract with Joe Walsh, and on his podcast, which is called White Flag with Joe Walsh. His journey has no shortage of unexpected turns, public moments, and some truly wild and funny stories that I'm excited to unpack. Joe, welcome to the Career Circus. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's great to be with you, my friend. It has been a weird, bizarre, fucking crazy journey. And because of that, nothing's off limits. You can ask me anything. We can talk about anything.
I love it. And I want to start by saying, like, I really admire your journey because it takes a lot of introspection and depth of character to be somebody who's elected to Congress as a Tea Party politician, as you were, and be pro-Trump, as you once were, and then become anti-Trump, despite a tidal wave of MAGA, despite the political temperature being so high. And then, a few months ago, switch your party affiliation from Republican to Democrat. And even if we don't agree on the issues, I feel that that level of introspection and focusing on the issues rather than tribal loyalty is what's missing in American politics, and it's what the country needs. And so I admire your depth of character, and I want to thank you for sticking to your principles and calling a spade and not getting sucked up in tribal loyalty and MAGA.
It's been difficult. I couldn't have done anything else. Like, I went from the Tea Party to the Democratic Party in 14 years. Now, at one level, that's like crazy. And it's been really hard. I make light of it sometimes, but it's been really, really hard. But I couldn't imagine not doing what I did because I do what I believe is the right thing to do. I was a jerk. I was a political asshole. People like me helped to get Trump elected that first time. I've got to go to my grave with that. But I woke up to that, and I've spent the last 6-7 years trying to do whatever I can against it, but it hasn't been easy.
Okay, imagine what along that journey has surprised you, both like within yourself or from the people around you or systems or in Congress, out of Congress. What did you not see coming that you had to react to?
When I stood up 7 years ago and publicly said, I'm against Donald Trump, I was a Republican then. I was a right-wing radio talk show host syndicated around the country. I was on Fox News every day, and I stood up and I said, no fucking more. I can't support him. I turned around and thought there'd be some Republicans following me. There were none. That surprised me. I thought there'd be some. That surprised me and disappointed me. I think the other thing that surprised me, I knew as a Republican coming out against Trump, I was going to get beat up and I was going to lose my livelihood. I was going to lose most of my supporters. But I lost almost all my friends. I lost close friends. I lost longtime supporters. To this day, that still surprises me a little bit. The one common thread I hear on the left and right, because of my weird journey from MAGA right to now a Democrat, my audience spans that journey. So I've got everybody politically who follow me. And one common thread is, oh my God, Americans don't know about our history. We don't teach civics anymore. I think there's got to be a good deal of that. And then the other thing I think, and this is going to be long and difficult, but I was out campaigning for Kamala Harris every day for 3 months last year. And in addition to the political stuff I'd hear, damn near everybody said how much they missed face-to-face conversation. We got these damn phones. We got all this technology. We got what you and I are doing right now. But I think there's a yearning for conversation in America, and I think there's a yearning for face-to-face conversation. So I think to help get us off the abyss, we got to start talking to each other. I believe, and I've said this for a while, America's like a married couple on the verge of a divorce. I believe that. And so we're going to a therapist one last time. And any good therapist would say, oh, sit down, we got to listen to each other one last time. I think that's what we have to do.
Now, since you mentioned you were on the trail with Kamala Harris last year, there must have been some crazy, unusual, weird stories that you encountered, weird moments you encountered.
Well, first of all, yeah, how weird that former Tea Party Joe Walsh is out there campaigning his ass off for Kamala Harris. I grew to really respect her. I got to know her husband really well. They're good people. I don't blame her for what happened. I blame Biden and some other things. But just the reaction I'd get as a Republican for Harris, a conservative for Harris, a lot of double takes. A lot of people had a difficult time because of what you said. We're so tribal that I'd go into Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, into Democratic areas campaigning for her. And people thought that was unusual that a conservative like me was doing that. It led to some disagreements, led to some lively talk. But that's a big part of what we got to get over, because we just don't do this enough anymore.
And on that note, did you find that campaign experience 14 years after your time in Congress to be very different to your time in Congress? Because you're having similar conversations. On the campaign trail for Harris, you're out of office, you were once in office. Was it really different, or were there kind of the issues, the personalities, the weird stories, were they kind of the same?
Kind of the same, but I've always been different in that I've always been a politician who's out there mixing it up and engaging with people face to face. The thing I'm most proud of as a former congressman is this. I held more open to the public face to face town halls in 2 years than any other member of Congress ever has. I literally felt like that was my job every weekend, and let anybody and everybody get in front of me, whether they liked me, whether they didn't vote for me, because I think that's really important. And the problem is, way too many of our politicians are cloistered. They're protected. They stay away from people. Trump gives the illusion that he's not that, that he's always out there answering questions. It's bullshit. But Democratic politicians, and even Kamala, you and I could debate, could she ever have won? I don't know. But the minute she became the nominee, she should have said, fuck it. And she should have gone out there every day. Not these big old rallies, but engaging with real people. She should have gone on your podcast, Joe Rogan, Tucker Carlson. She should have gone everywhere. But they protected her. And I think Democrats are learning from that. I've never been that kind of politician. Democrats got to stop that, because American voters want to see authenticity. And again, that's part of what Mamdani did was wonderful. I disagree with him on a lot of issues, I suppose, but I wholeheartedly embrace and support him. And what he did was he got out there and he engaged with people. He wasn't in some fucking ivory tower. He was out there campaigning with people, and he was anti-establishment, which is really, really important. We talk about my journey from Tea Party to the Democratic Party, but what I've always been is an outsider. When I got elected to Congress, the Republican Party fought against me. I ran as a Republican. The Republican Party wanted nothing to do with me. I went to Washington, and the Republican Party establishment hated me. I railed against the establishment. So I've always been an outsider, an anti-establishment guy. We're living in a populist moment. You may not like populism. I am a populist. What does that mean? I think all that means right now is what you said. For a while now, average Americans are pissed off at an establishment a political system they don't think is meeting their needs, listening to them. And so then they gravitate toward people like Trump and now Mamdani. But we're living in that moment. And so I think Trump is a fake populist. I think he's an evil populist. But the Democrats have not recognized this populist moment, the anger. Mamdani has.
Right. And that's why I think Kamala lost, because he was just, I'm against Trump. But like, buddy, what are you for? And this is probably not an original take, but when she came on The View, I think it was last August, yeah. I wouldn't change anything from Joe's. Like, when you buy a new apartment or a house, you go in and say, you know what, I'm going to keep the same rug. No one in human history has ever done that. It's complete lunacy.
She, and again, I really grew to respect her, but I agree with you. She did not understand this moment. The only chance she had to win once Biden stepped down was to say, fuck it. I love you, Joe, but damn it. People are pissed. Eggs are too expensive. We've got to be better on the border. And she should have just, she should have been an anti-establishment candidate. It's just not who she was.
Now, switching gears a little bit, I first learned about you watching Sacha Baron Cohen. Well, actually, you can tell the story because it involves you. Essentially, he pranked you into endorsing a program that arms toddlers with guns to keep their classroom safe.
The intensive three-week kindergarten course introduces specially selected children from 12 to 4 years old to pistols, rifles, semi-automatics, and a rudimentary knowledge of mortars. In less than a month, a first grader can become a first grenader.
How did that come about?
He got me good. Sacha Baron Cohen got me good. And by the way, when Sacha Baron Cohen gets you good, all you can do is say, fuck it, he got me. This was, I think, Israel's 75th anniversary, and I got a call from this group saying that they were going to fly me out and put me up in D.C. I was going to get an award as a great friend of Israel's. And part of it was I'm going to sit down and all of the award winners do a 45-minute interview talking about how much Israel means to them. So they flew me out to D.C. They put us up in a hotel, sat down for this long, hour and a half interview talking about Israel. And in that hour and a half interview, talking about various things Israel does, there was this little section where they talked, he talked about Israel has this anti-terror program where they literally train kindergartners to defend against terrorists. And again, I'm glazy-eyed, and I just said, wow, great. Got exactly what I said, but obviously making it look like I endorsed this program of arming four-year-olds. So that little snippet in an hour and a half interview, boom, got me, and the rest is history.
Yeah, as a viewer, I really admire his comedy as somebody who writes comedy myself. Like, as a viewer, that was so funny, especially because if you recall the episode, he goes to meet Matt Gaetz, former yeah. Congressman Matt Gaetz, and Matt Gaetz was like, do you think you can get a congressman to say this? Don't be ridiculous. And then next got is you, former congressman, saying, yeah, let's ask really, four-year-olds.
It's really, I mean, it's a gift. It's really good what they do. The lengths they went to just to get that 15 to 30 second clip. It's like they put me asleep for an hour and a half of an interview. And again, all on me, I fucked up. But you don't even realize eventually what you're saying. It was interesting.
What happened after it aired? So once you'd said it, did you realize when it was in editing or did it take it for it to air?
No, we didn't even notice. I do remember, though, my wife was in the studio and I believe her. She said that when I did say that, she looked at me and thought, that's odd. And then when we went back to the hotel that night, she brought it up and I didn't even really remember it. But then when we went home, we tried to contact the group that gave me the award, and there's really no trail of anything. And then we hired a lawyer. Then we knew something was up.
So you hired a lawyer. Was that to prevent the clip from airing? Because presumably you signed a release.
Absolutely. Yes, it was. I'm forgetting the term, but yeah, signed a release. But I think we were going to try to prove that everything was done under false pretenses. I don't remember. But eventually it just got to the point where I just said, look, Sacha Baron Cohen, he got me. I'm in the long list of people who've been gotten. Just fucking suck it up and say, he got you.
I like that approach. Did that approach or that clip airing, did it benefit you in any way?
It aired everywhere. And it's still something. I mean, even since becoming a Democrat, I mean, look, most Democrats have embraced me. But there are plenty of Democrats that still remember Tea Party Joe Walsh, and that's always something that comes up. And so, again, I just have to swat it away with honesty and humor, but it'll always be there.
And is that the wildest story from your career?
No, there are a lot like that. And generally, look, because I've always been a public person and I've always been a very outspoken public person, the old Joe Walsh and this Joe Walsh, you've always got to be on the lookout for people who are trying to do that to you. Constantly. That's a constant battle. And I'll bet in the 14 to 15 years of me, you know, in the bazillion hours of public tape and video, there are probably two or three or four times where I really fucked up and stepped in it. That was one of the biggest.
Can you share another one? Because I'm not necessarily trying to say, oh, Joe, you screwed up. That's not the intent. Often bad experiences make for great stories, and that's what I'm trying to uncover. To me, being pranked by Sacha Baron Cohen seems pretty up there. But you're saying there's things that exceed that, so I'd love to learn more.
Well, another one that jumps to mind was when I ran for re-election in 2012 to my congressional seat near the end of a long, hard campaign. And by the way, exhaustion is a real part of this. I had a debate with my opponent. I ended the debate with my opponent. I was tired. I was hungry. And the media, I had to have a press conference, and the media is bombarding me with a bunch of questions. And this one jerk who I know, this media guy who I know, asked me a question about abortion and got me to because I wasn't thinking straight, got me to say that abortion should never be legal, even if like the mother's life is in danger. Screw it. You got to save the baby. I didn't say that, but I said something like that. And that this was 2 weeks before election day. And that blew up and became a huge story. Like Joe Walsh says, kill the mother if you have to. That was another one that hurt me real bad. God, I wish I had a better memory, but there are more smaller examples of that kind of shit. But generally, I've been really good about not being afraid to say what I believe.
And the abortion example, do you feel like that could have cost you the campaign?
No doubt. Easily could have cost me the campaign. Certainly would have made the final result a lot closer. A lot closer, no doubt. That's one of the biggest boo-boos I've ever made publicly.
Yeah. Well, the thing about public life is, you know, well, we all make mistakes, and those who live in the public eye make mistakes publicly. And I hope what I'm about to share gives you a little bit of comfort, because Sacha Baron Cohen does political pranks on a bigger scale than me, but I kind of do political pranks too.
Cool.
2020, I got several folks in MAGA world on a prank. So the first one was Tommy Lauren. Are you familiar with the Cameo app? Cameo is you pay a public figure. I'm using the term public figure very loosely. A small amount or big amount, depending on who they are and what they want their fee to be, to record a message. Happy birthday to my wife. She's whatever. It's a big fan of Real House.
Yeah.
And so Tommy Lauren's on there. I pay her $85 and I say, I write the script. And I said, Tommy, I'd like you to thank all the Indian Americans for supporting Trump, because Trump is wise like an owl. As you say in India, wise like an ulu. Now, here's the thing. The word ulu literally in Hindi means owl. So if you looked it up on Google Translate, ulu equals owl. But you have to be Indian to know ulu and owl is an insult in India. Owls are considered to be stupid. So if you want to insult them, you're like, son of an owl. And so she recorded that. I posted it on Twitter. It went viral to the point where it became a trending topic in India. It was covered on the evening news in India. So there's a Washington Post reporter in Delhi. She's sliding into my DMs and she's taking a picture of a TV, and the news anchor is saying like, American commentator pranked, discussing Indian, something like that. And he's sending it to me, and it's just like, you've seen this, right? I'm like, no, I'm in New York. Like, I'm not in New Delhi. I haven't seen it. Thanks for telling me. It was covered by Pakistani news. I did a ton of media for it, and it gave me the confidence to get him again. A week or two before the election, I paid Tommy again, Deb Gorka, Corey Lewandowski, and Joe Arpaio. I can't remember the amount. It was a different amount for each of them. I paid them to thank Satan for supporting Trump. And they're like, thank you. You do the merchant. You buy the merchandise. You come to the rallies. You're a loyal supporter. It blew up on the media. You may have seen it.
I think I did. I remember that one.
The one that I did didn't, I was really proud of it, but it didn't catch on, was I paid Joe Arpaio to say, immigrants, we get the job done, which if you've seen Hamilton, the musical, is a line from that. And for those who don't know, Joe Arpaio is probably the least pro-immigration person in the country. I was really proud to get him, but that one didn't blow up. So it just goes, you just don't know what's going to go wrong.
It's an art, what you do.
Thank you.
It is. It's impressive to watch. And as a public figure, as a politician, you can either be really careful and aware that there are people out there like you trying to do what you do, or you can just say, fuck it, I'm generally going to say what I believe, even if I step in it sometimes. I generally prefer to always be that.
Yeah, own your mistakes, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I was really surprised at how easily somebody really good can get somebody to say something they really don't understand or believe.
Yeah, as somebody who's done it, it's kind of fun.
Well, if you got Seb Gorka, I love you, because he's an absolute ass.
Yeah, it is, but then it's like, oh my God, what am I messing with? I don't have Sacha Baron Cohen's lawyers.
But no, you sign a release. For something like that, you sign a release. But generally, when I'm out there in my history, when I'm out there doing an event or giving a speech and anybody and everybody coming up to you with a phone, can I ask you a question? I mean, you don't know what could come back and bite you.
Does it frustrate you that when you're trying to communicate a nuanced position, that you get reduced to a small soundbite that takes away all nuance?
Yeah, but that's always been the turf. And you understand as a public figure, a politician, that is the turf. And even though I've got a master's degree from the University of Chicago, I generally have always spoken like a fucking common man. And so I try to keep things really simple and straight.
Yeah. Well, we both went to the University of Chicago. I have one or two funny stories from my time there. Do you?
No, God, no. You probably have more than I do, because I was married with two kids.
Wow.
I was commuting. It was graduate school. So I really didn't have a lot of fun down there.
Okay. So
Go as an undergrad?
No, postgrad. I went to both.
That's right.
Yeah. I describe getting an MBA from the University of Chicago as a very expensive way to make friends.
True. Great degree, though. Great place, right?
Yeah, it was a great time. And after completing my degree, about 6 months later, I naturalized and became an American citizen.
Cool.
You probably know this because you're a former congressman, but when you become an American citizen, you have to do a quiz on certain aspects of American life. For me, it was really funny. It was only one question. I was expecting questions on how many states are there, which ocean flanks the eastern seaboard. That's what I prepared for. The person just asked me one question. Do you have six-figure grad school debt? And I was like, yes. They go, you're American. Come on in. That's all it takes.
That's a riot.
Yeah. And this was during the first Trump presidency. So I, you know, had the oath, and Trump comes on the video, and it's a whole...
You know, again, that America, I adore America. And it was kind of weird, but cool and necessary to be in London last week, to be away out of this country on July 4th. I was not in a celebratory mood. I fucking love this country. I despise what that man and my former party are doing to it. So it was cool to be in London. I felt like a guest at a wedding where I didn't know a fucking soul. And I'd go into pubs and different bars in different neighborhoods and engage with some Londoners with conversations about America. And a lot of people would say Trump's an idiot and an ignoramus. And I would just nod my head and smile. That's all I did all day.
Yeah, I find it very interesting because when I'm in New York, when I'm in the U.S., Trump is, you know, roughly 50% of people like him, 50% don't. You come to London and it's like 90% of people are like, what's going on over there? Like, do they really like him over there? So it's very different. How did you like London? Did you feel that being in London helped you evaluate the state that America's in?
Yeah, this has been a rough 6 months. And look, again, I often have fun with where I'm at politically, but it's really difficult. I'm not of the right and I'm not of the left. And I'm kind of in this middle place, and it's hard to find your place. I became a Democrat a month ago, but the whole party hasn't embraced me, and maybe they never will. So I'm in this weird place, and I'm not your age. I'm an old fart. And I'm wondering, God, should I keep doing this? Should I keep fighting politically? Will I ever run for office again? So to go to London, to get out of this country for a week and just sort of relax and think, and I walked everywhere, very great walking city. Yeah. I didn't want to do any tours. I just wanted to see shit on my own. So I spent a lot of time just walking, reflecting, and thinking.
And through those thoughts, did you come up with what's next for Joe Walsh?
Well, what's next is I don't want to stop fighting politically. I think I have a few more years in me. I'd love to run again. I don't know that I ever can. I know I got a unique voice because nobody's been on this fucking journey. And so it's a matter just of getting the voice in front of as many people as I can. That's what I'm going to try to do.
And when you say getting your voice out there and running again, do you have a sense if that's governor, mayor, Congress,
president?
All the above. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm from outside of Chicago. That was my congressional district. My wife and I have lived in D.C. for the last few years. I've got to find a place to live. I can't handle cold weather anymore. By the way, the weather in London was beautiful.
Yeah.
My God, I didn't think it was like that. So I want to find somewhere warm. I want to find like a purple state, not too red, not too blue, where somebody like me maybe could run again.
I've got a pitch for you, since you love London.
Talk to me.
Run for office here.
Because your story is so unique.
Now, you might have to live for, you know, a few years, establish residency, but I can see it working.
That's really interesting. I'm not going to give you his name, but I had lunch with a political strategist in London who said the same fucking thing. Come here. How long does it take to get residency?
I don't know, because I'm a natural born British citizen, so I've never had to go through that process. But I believe that the difference between here and the US is, in the US, you get a green card for 5 years. So you have to work your way up to a green card. 5 years green card, then you naturalize. Here, I think you work your way up to the residency. 1 year after permanent residency, I think you become a citizen, but I'm not sure. I know an immigration lawyer in London, if that helps.
We'll see. I
Yeah. But the beauty and majesty of London, I would argue, offsets it. And here's the other nice thing, and I hope this doesn't touch a nerve, but you know the nice thing about London? No guns.
I'd have a hard time with that.
So this is fascinating to me because, and this goes back to what we started with. Yeah. As I said, I really admire your journey, the depth of character you've shown, especially because it comes with risk. In a country that's armed and the political temperature is so high and the access to guns is so easy. And so for you to take the positions you've taken, it's risky for you personally. And
gotcha.
And so that makes you taking this position even like more admirable. But the nice thing about here is the cops don't have guns. No one's coming for you. So the fact that you then say you're uncomfortable with that, I'm like, help me understand that.
It's so fascinating, my friend. I love this conversation because this is what's so interesting about America. Like, if I walked into a restaurant or a Starbucks or anywhere and I saw armed civilians, I wouldn't bat an eye or I'd feel more secure. But half of America, they walk into a Starbucks where there are armed folks in that Starbucks, they'd be absolutely scared to death. Making no judgment. There's a real divide. Look, I believe in freedom. I believe in the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, whatever. I believe that's what makes America so cool. That's what I've always been politically.
So the fact that there's fewer to no guns in the UK is a negative.
I could not live in a country where I did not have the right to bear arms. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
But does that mean like does it take a long time or nobody can ever get a license to have a gun?
I believe it just takes a long time. There's a lot of regulation, but you do find like shooting clubs. It does exist. Yeah. Well,
that's
Joe,
really
we'll have to leave it there. Just one thing before we wrap is where can folks who are trying to find out about your views on defending American democracy, we talk about the podcast, talk about your Substack, where else can folks follow your work?
And by the way, before I do that, thank you for this. You're very good at what you do.
Oh, thank you.
I've done a gazillion conversations and interviews. You are a very good conversationalist and an interviewer. I've really liked this.
Thank you.
Walsh Freedom on every social media platform, and the podcast and the Substack is The Social Contract with Joe Walsh.
Excellent. Thank you, Joe. Real pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
You got it. Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to The Career Circus. On our next show, we'll dive into the world of the Yakuza in conversation with Jake Adelstein, an American journalist and author in Japan whose work inspired the hit HBO Max show Tokyo Vice. But for now, goodbye.